It is Friday, March the 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, could newly proposed talks between the U.S. and North Korea produce good results?
If you're just being sort of cynical and projecting the past into the future, you would expect that they would, the time would come when they would back out of this. You can't say for sure. It's worth a try.
And new U.S. tariffs on imported steel and aluminum.
Our industries have been targeted for years and years. It's going to stop.
Also ahead, International Women's Day, plus a little something from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman, and what marks a potentially dramatic breakthrough in the North Korean nuclear standoff, South Korean envoy Chung Yung-yong told reporters at the White House late Thursday. He relayed a message to the White House that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is eager to meet with President Trump. Chung also was in Washington to brief all U.S. officials about his talks with the North Korean leader, saying that Mr. Kim had committed to denuclearization and to suspending nuclear or missile sites.
The Republic of Korea, the United States, and our partners stand together in insisting that we not repeat the mistakes of the past and that the pressure will continue until North Korea matches its words with concrete actions.
VOA's Lori London gets some insight in all of this from Barry Naughton. He's a scholar at the University of California at San Diego School of Global Policy.
Well, of course, it's astonishing news and definitely positive if it works through. I mean, I think the two key elements are the statement by envoy from South Korea, Chung, that Kim will both refrain from new tests and accept the reality that the U.S. and South Korean forces will carry out their exercises in the sea near the Korean Peninsula. So those are quite dramatic concessions on the part of Kim Jong-un. Of course, the doubt, you know, the hesitation that people still feel is we didn't hear Kim Jong-un make those statements. We only have Envoy Chung's word for them. So it remains to be seen exactly what will happen. But if this is real, it's definitely to be welcomed.
Do you think it's because of the pretty strong arm tactics that we've seen or from the president and this harsh words, or do you think it's that the sanctions are really starting to bite? What do you think led to this?
Well, I think there's two sides to it. I mean, one is, yes, the sanctions are beginning to bite. And I think in that sense, the administration's narrative is reasonable. And it also involves, I think, significant action by China to not impose as complete a blockade as we would like, but still to take very serious measures that have an impact on North Korea. But there's another side, and that is North Korea has been able to complete a round of testing of missiles and nuclear weapons that make it plausibly a nuclear power. And so it makes sense for Kim Jong-un to now turn around and make some concessions, try and cool things off and prevent military action by the United States.
What strikes me is that, you know, that they've worked so hard to develop these weapons, that they've bragged about them, that they have billboards around the nation, and that it's just a major talking point for their leadership, that they would suddenly just be willing to just forego all that.
Well, they're only willing, I mean, this is what remains to be seen, right? But the promise is that for some kind of full demilitarization of the Korean Peninsula, and we've never been able to agree on that before. So it's not clear that we'll be able to agree on it now, but maybe. I mean, maybe things have changed.
Have we ever had a U.S. president actually sit down with a leader of North Korea?
I don't believe so, not that I know of.
Do you think it's a good idea?
I kind of wish them on each other. I kind of wish them on each other.
Mm-hmm.
I think Donald Trump would be a great interlocutor of Kim Jong-un, and Kim Jong-un would be a great interlocutor with Donald Trump. And if maybe they can come to something. Look, we have no better options.
Mm-hmm.
So although I'm, of course, suspicious and not quite convinced that this is what it seems to be. But since we have nothing better to offer, I think let's see how this goes and hope that it turns out for the best.
Is there any way that this could backfire in a detrimental way?
Well, if the leaders somehow formed an even more intense personal dislike or anger at each other, that could be bad. But that seems to me a risk that's probably worth taking.
So do you think that overall North Korea is actually getting worried about the threats, that this president isn't afraid to go to war?
Well, I don't know. We don't have any way to see inside Kim Jong-un's mind. So it might be that. I can't exclude it. But again, I think we should stress they've won, right? They have nuclear weapons. They have delivery systems. They attended the Olympics. The best approach for them right now would be to dial down tensions in order for them to keep what they have already got. So the question of whether they want to just temporarily dial down tensions in order to move the U.S. out of this energized state in which it's in, or whether they're willing to look for a permanent solution is something that we just can't tell yet.
Do you think a first meeting like that would be able to accomplish anything, or would it just be sort of an introduction?
It would certainly just be an introduction. But I think we would quickly get some indication about how serious the North Koreans could potentially be. But of course, the experience that we've had with the North Koreans in the past is that they have backed out of every understanding that we've ever had. So, if you're just being sort of cynical and projecting the past into the future, you would expect that they would, a time would come when they would back out of this. You can't say for sure. It's worth a try.
That's Barry Naughton. He is a scholar at the University of California at San Diego's School of Global Policy. He was speaking with VOA's Lori London. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. President Trump has signed companion proclamations placing 25% tariffs on steel coming into the U.S. and 10% tariffs on imported aluminum. President said he was making these moves to protect the U.S. economy and national security.
Our industries have been targeted for years and years, decades in fact, by unfair foreign trade practices leading to the shuttered plants and mills, the laying off of millions of workers, and the decimation of entire communities. And that's going to stop, right? It's going to stop.
The across-the-board taxes are to go into effect in about 15 days. Mr. Trump said the tariffs are in response to actions by other countries that have hurt U.S. steel and aluminum industries.
Other countries have added production capacity that far exceeds demand and flooded the world market with cheap metal that is subsidized by foreign governments, creating jobs for their country and taking away jobs from our country.
And surrounded by U.S. steel and aluminum workers, Mr. Trump said he was keeping a promise he made during his presidential campaign and said that tariffs could be relaxed if other countries can assure that their products would not damage the U.S. economy. The president also said his administration would look at allies such as Australia and European countries, as well as NATO members who do not deal fairly with the United States. U.S. steelworker Dusty Stevens said the tariffs will help his plant in the state of Kentucky return to 100% capacity and employ hundreds of people.
My father worked in the industry and worked at that plant for 40 years, so this hits home. for all of us at Hallsville. By these tariffs going into place, this gives us ability to come back to 100% capacity, investing over $100 million to our plant, and over 300 and some odd jobs will be brought back to the communities.
After an outcry from U.S. lawmakers, some industry executives and foreign governments, such as Canada and Mexico, are being given specific exemptions from the tariffs for an indefinite period while negotiations continue on the North American Free Trade Agreement. However, President Trump said that if the NAFTA negotiations do not turn out favorably, his administration could terminate the deal, but he added that he thought a deal would be made.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News.
The UN Environment Program is taking aim at corporations and governments that threaten and intimidate environmental defenders and foul the planet for financial gain. Lisa Schlein reporting now from the UN in Geneva.
I've learned over the years that I'm not alone.
A film that began a panel discussion is narrated by Kenyan environmental activist Phyllis Omido. She succeeded in closing down a lead smelting plant in a slum near Mombasa, which he said spewed poisonous fumes into the air, killing and harming local residents, including her child. While that battle was won, the fight is far from over. UN Environment's head of communication for environmental governance, Niam Branigan, says threats against environmental defenders continue.
We've been receiving messages over the last 2 days to say that another environmental defender has been shot dead in the Philippines. Ricardo Mayumi of the Ifugao peasant movement, he's been leading the opposition to the mini hydro dam in Santa Clara of the Santa Clara Power Corporation, and we believe that he has been shot dead.
Between 2002 and 2013, the United Nations reports 908 people in 35 countries have been killed defending the environment and land. UN Deputy High Commissioner for Human Rights Kate Gilmore says all human rights depend on the environment. Yet, she says, people continue to pollute the Earth's resources for short-term economic gain, endangering the lives and livelihoods of future generations.
The polluter must pay, so we say. But in practice, it is those who have contributed the least who are paying the most. We know what to do. Defend the environment and defend those who defend it, and hold those who violate the law accountable.
Bianca Jagger is president and chief executive of the Bianca Jagger Human Rights Foundation. She calls for those who assassinate environmental defenders of indigenous peoples and their communities to be brought to justice. But she acknowledges that is difficult because governments often join forces with companies that exploit indigenous rights.
And so we need to make a call to all those multinationals or national companies that are involved in dams, mining, and other exploitation of the land, who want to take the land away from indigenous people and their ancestral land from indigenous people, that we need to put an end to that.
UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and the Environment, John Knox, was instrumental in pushing forward the Environmental Rights Initiative that seeks to promote, protect, and respect human and environmental rights. He says it is absolutely crucial that more be done to protect environmental defenders.
4 people on average a week are killed around the world for trying to protect the environment. If we can't protect the people who are trying to protect the environment for the rest of us, everything else we're doing will be ineffective. So it's absolutely vital that we do that.
Knox says the right to a healthy environment has been adopted by more than 100 countries. In an ironic twist, he notes one place where it has not been adopted is at the United Nations. He says it is time for this world body to recognize that everyone should be able to enjoy his or her human right to a safe and healthy environment. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
International Women's Day, celebrated on March 8th, recognized women's achievements without regard to race or ethnicity, language, or social or economic divisions. The day emerged from the activities of labor movements at the turn of the 20th century in North America and across Europe. The latest episode of VOA's Plugged In with Greta Van Susteren explored recent changes in the conversation involving women, sexual assault, and leadership in the world. VOA's Steve Reddish has more.
Hashtag MeToo and hashtag NoMore social media campaigns are in the spotlight on International Women's Day, although it is not just Hollywood that is of concern. On Plugged In with Greta Van Susteren, Congresswoman Susan Brooks said the private sector was ahead of the government in dealing with sexual harassment.
Congress certainly, and as the chair of the House Ethics Committee, as you know, we are certainly dealing with that in Congress as well. But I'm really proud to be a part, again, of a bipartisan effort led by women and men in Congress to improve the processes in the House so that people can come forward and complain about sexual harassment.
The viral social media campaigns that started in the U.S. is reaching places like Pakistan, where VOA's Aisha Tanzim is monitoring developments.
So when the Me Too movement started in U.S., you saw the repercussions of that in Pakistan, and, you know, less so in Afghanistan, but in the cities. And you saw women in Pakistan posting their own Me Too stories and really connecting with Hollywood and really connecting and saying, we are suffering the same thing.
Social media is proving to be an important tool in the fight for women's rights, according to Kamisa Kamara from Partners Global.
I see more and more cases of domestic violence, which are advertised, sort of, on Facebook or Twitter. And so women are aware of what other women are facing in their homes, outside, in terms of, for example, sexual harassment. And what they do is they talk to one another and they provide advice to one another. They coach and mentor each other in order to face those situations.
In 1995, then First Lady Hillary Clinton laid down a marker about women's rights at a UN conference on women in Beijing.
If there is one message that echoes forth from this conference, let it be that human rights are women's rights, and women's rights are human rights once and for all.
But today, two decades later, there are still challenges even in developed nations.
We need more women to run for office. That's something that the U.S. has actually fallen behind on relative to other countries. Other countries have more women in their parliaments or in their congresses than we do in the United States. And so we do want more women to run at all levels of government.
There are some empirical studies that show that when women are involved in peace processes, then peace is longstanding, sustainable, and then issues such as rape tend to disappear.
Experts like Kamara believe that Liberia is one of the nations where women's participation in the political arena has brought major political change. Steve Reddish, VOA News.
And for what's being said on social media about International Women's Day, we turn to VOA's Sarah Williams.
Former Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton tweets, in honor of hashtag International Women's Day, I want to celebrate some of the women and girls who inspire me every day. These women resist inequality, insist on a better world, persist against all odds, and enlist others in our shared fights. Brandon tweets on hashtag International Women's Day, let's remember all the women who are completely smeared by the left, but who all persist through the liberal hate. Sarah Sanders, Kellyanne Conway, Melania Trump, Nikki Haley, much more, keep up the good work. NBC News tweets, McDonald's has flipped its famous Golden Arches logo for hashtag International Women's Day. And there's a photo of some of the staff at McDonald's. Usually they have hats that have M. Today it's been turned around so it's a W. Comedian Cyrus McQueen tweets, happy hashtag International Women's Day to all the amazing women who make life worth living, the wives, mothers, grandmothers, and sisters whose sacrifices are undeniable, whose impact is immeasurable, and whose love and strength keep this world going. Musings tweets, when you judge a woman by her appearance, it doesn't define her, it defines you. Hashtag no to body shaming, hashtag girls protect girls, hashtag International Women's Day.
And many thanks, Sarah. That is VOA's Sarah Williams. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Dried flowers are put into a plastic bucket, then covered with boiling water. Vegetable oil is added and then shaken. All part of the process of making bars of soap in Kyrgyzstan. Myram Kulmyreva is a local entrepreneur. She says, we make soap from sea buckthorn for eczema. Also, calendula, nettle, chamomile are good for the skin. The Shaker Salmon Soap is based on an ancient recipe. With the help of Japanese investment, women make and sell the all-natural ingredient soap throughout the country. The soaps are good for dry skin. Some are made with goat's milk, but the village has always been known for its soaps and creams. Agawa Masasumi is the soap project advisor. He says the soaps are in big demand from tourists. The women carve and wrap about 100 bars of soap a day, and they sell for about $2 a bar. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. You know, beginning in the 1950s and for nearly 40 years afterwards, vinyl records were the primary medium for music and radio, and then the digital audio industry nearly wiped out the production of vinyl records, but, you know, not completely. Over the years, records have been making somewhat of a comeback, partly for the nostalgia and partly for the artistic packaging and characteristic warm sounds that records seem to produce. VOA's Jim Stevenson and Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald remember vinyl as the annual record store day approaches.
Just take those old records off the shelf. I sit and listen to them by myself. Today's music ain't got the same soul. I like that old time of rock and roll.
Jim, both you and I have been around long enough to remember the heyday of vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
That's a nice way of saying, you know, we're not
a little
young
older
anymore. We're not kids. But yeah, Record Store Day is a great idea. It was started in 2007 to honor independent record retailers around the world. And it's more relevant today than ever before because vinyl sales have been on the upswing for the past several years. People really enjoy vinyl. And vinyl gives artists a chance to really get creative with their packaging and with digging into their vaults and unearthing some really cool stuff. And this year is no different. One of the highlights include a Led Zeppelin 7-inch vinyl disc featuring a previously unreleased mix of rock and roll and the song Friends. Zeppelin is celebrating their 50th anniversary in 2018. Jimmy Page is promising a lot of good stuff. So this, I guess you could say, is the opening shot. Sufjan Stevens, who's a really good singer-songwriter, he's giving us a 10-inch single featuring his Oscar-nominated single, Mystery of Love. That was from the movie Call Me By Your Name.
Mm-hmm.
U2 will have a limited edition picture disc featuring two versions of their new song, Lights of Home. That's from their latest album, Songs of Experience. Taylor Swift is getting in on Record Store Day. She will re-release her albums Fearless, 1989, and her self-titled debut disc, all on special colored vinyl. And Bruce Springsteen is going the colored vinyl route, too. He'll give us his 1995 Greatest Hits album as a double disc set on red vinyl.
Oh, I love it.
Now, there's always a particular artist who's chosen as the Record Store Day ambassador. This year, it's the rap duo Run the Jewels. And they're releasing a metal collector's box featuring several things, including a vinyl EP with remixes and instrumental tracks. They'll also throw in a special slip mat and sticker. So if you're a Run the Jewels fan, this is a chance for you to really get some swag. Rapper Nas, this sounds really intriguing. Nas, one of the best-known rappers, will drop a vinyl edition of his performance of his album Illmatic, which he did at the Kennedy Center right here in Washington, D.C., along with the National Symphony Orchestra. And that's really just the tip of the iceberg. As I said, Record Store Day is coming up on April 21st. We have several weeks lead up to it, so I'm sure there will be many other releases coming out. If you want to read more about it, I have details on my Twitter page, Ray on the Hits, and you can also go to VOA1's Facebook page, VOA1 The Hits.
We were all amazed by the clarity of CDs when they came out and how much more we heard within the music. But that warmth of vinyl just grabs you, and it hasn't gone away.
No, it hasn't. It's just a timeless appeal. There's the warmth of the vinyl sound, and there also, at least to me, is the appeal of holding a record album in your hand. Because the record album, it was like a canvas. Mm-hmm. And artists were able to do so much with it, much more so than a CD jacket, and of course, way more than today's, you know, downloads and streams, right, where you can't hold anything. I miss those days, and like I say, those days are still with us because vinyl is very, very popular.
Thanks for spinning it around with us, Ray. Check him out on Twitter.
At Ray on the Hits.
Thank you, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
Now whip out your big 10-inch, record up, band of players, a band of
players. Oh, yeah. Hey, listen, a U.S. anthropologist is claiming that bones found on a remote Pacific island in the 1940s were those of the legendary lost aviator, Amelia Earhart. Richard Jant used some new technology to measure the bones that had been previously thought to be those of a man. He says they are definitely Amelia Earhart's. Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific during their attempt to fly around the world back in 1937. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today on the Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. Latest world news is straight ahead, and we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zainab Abdul-Rahman, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday, everyone.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The long reach of terrorism threatens to steal the future of countless Africans, said Secretary Rex Tillerson in a recent speech. In the last year alone, thousands of Africans have died at the hands of terrorists. In response to this growing threat, the United States sanctioned 7 ISIS-affiliated groups, including ISIS West Africa and ISIS Somalia, and their leaders, in an effort to cut off the resources that these groups use to carry out attacks. To prevail against such evil forces, said Secretary Tillerson, the United States has committed to working with African partners to rid the continent and the world of terrorism by addressing the drivers of conflict that lead to radicalization and recruitment in the first place, and building the institutional law enforcement capacity of African nations. Terrorism knows no borders. In the Sahel and the Lake Chad Basin, Boko Haram, ISIS West Africa, Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, and other groups are adaptable, they're resilient, and capable of launching attacks throughout the area, noted Secretary Tillerson. Regional cooperation is crucial to disrupting those attacks and denying these terrorist organizations the capability to plan and carry out attacks in the future. The nations of Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Mauritania, and Niger, also known as the G5 Sahel, are pooling their expertise and resources to fight terrorism. To support their efforts, the United States has committed $60 million in security assistance to enable G5 Sahel countries to counter terrorism across the region. In addition, for more than a decade, the United States has supported the Trans-Sahara Counterterrorism Partnership to provide training and promote cooperation between military, law enforcement, and civil actors across North and West Africa. In East Africa, the United States has used the Partnership for Regional East Africa Counterterrorism since 2009 to do the same. The Counterterrorism Partnership Fund is another important resource that helps African partners build their capacity to counterterrorism. Since 2016, the United States has contributed more than $140 million to help partners prevent terrorist safe havens and the recruitment through these partnerships. The United States also provides the African Union mission in Somalia with training, equipment, mentorship, unarmed aerial surveillance, and operational support to enable African nations to fight terrorism in Somalia. There are no quick fixes to the terrorist threat, but the United States is committed to meeting the challenge head-on in partnership with African countries so the continent ultimately can become a place of prosperity, freedom, and safety.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From Washington.